From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The battlefield is in Iraq, but the war is everywhere now, in our media-saturated lives, in the papers, on the radio, and especially, universally, in this war on TV. Gulf War I was lampooned for its mob of groping reporters trapped in distant briefing rooms. Gulf War II is in our laps. The swirling dust, the sweat and grimaces and smiles of U.S. troops, the terrible operatic spectacle of Baghdad under vast balls of fire. So is this the way we want our war? Is it too gung-ho, not gung-ho enough? Is it coolly accurate and complete, or embedded in American war passions? Tonight on Point, the media at war and the picture we're getting. We begin tonight with war coverage from a different angle. Donna Harmon, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, has been following the war through the media lens of Cairo, Egypt. I asked her if there are different wars being broadcast in the U.S. and in her current base.
Well, it's been, I think, really interesting, even personally, to be here in Egypt, in an Arab country during this war, to see how people here perceive it and what they're shown, what they see of the war, what they understand to be the storyline. And having a sense of what people in the United States are seeing, I can see that they're really seeing different images, different explanations, and thus getting a different sense of what the story is.
At the top level, how would you describe the difference between how a citizen in Cairo or elsewhere might be understanding what's going on and how the average American might understand it?
Well, of course, everyone has the same idea about what's happening. The Americans and the British and the Australians are in there, and they are doing well, and they're advancing on Baghdad. That, I mean, no one can dispute those facts. But other than that, I think the emphasis here is on really different things. I mean, you would not really see here any of the pictures that you might see in the United States of Iraqi troops surrendering. What you might see much more of here, on the other hand, is civilian casualties, Iraqi civilian casualties, and the suffering and the horrors of war. Stuff like that. So you just get a different side of what the whole thing looks like.
Now, people in Cairo would be watching a lot of this via Al Jazeera, the Arab satellite television news network. Are you saying that Al Jazeera would not show Iraqi troops surrendering?
Well, first of all, a lot of people do watch Al Jazeera. Of course, Al Jazeera is a satellite TV station, so I'd say about 20% of the population here would get satellite TV. But what happens is that the satellite TV, Al Jazeera in particular, although there are other stations, feeds into the local station. So basically, a lot of the images do come from that. And no, they don't completely ignore the facts of the war, if there are facts of war. They don't completely ignore that there are Iraqis surrendering. But that'll sort of pass by in a real hurry and move on to different images, to other aspects of the war.
Does that suggest a political stance on Al Jazeera's part? And what about the politics of American coverage? You're watching both. Are there political stamps or perspectives that come through loud and clear?
Well, of course there are. I'll give you some examples. I mean, in the United States, a lot of times this war is being called by the correspondents, by the reporters, a war of liberation, and certainly that's what the administration of the United States is calling it. On Al Jazeera, they call it an invasion. Over and over again, they call it an invasion. Another thing I noticed on Al Jazeera, they keep saying U.S. officials or President Bush claims or, you know, asserts that. And then when they talk about the Iraqis say. So the bias is very clear where it's coming from. And, you know, we have the same thing on the American side. I'm not saying that it's just on one side or the other.
From where you sit in Cairo, what does that slant look like on the American side?
Funny enough, it's hard for me to see what people are seeing back in the United States because I don't have the benefit of seeing, for example, any of the networks. But I think that here people's sense is that the Americans are not getting the whole story. And that's why I think it was very, very interesting to see how people reacted to the shots of the captured POWs and the dead American soldiers. Because in some ways there was a certain amount of, I don't know, excitement or even, I noticed some expressions of happiness, in fact, to see those pictures. And I was surprised by that reaction. And as it turns out, there's a sense here that, you know, the Americans don't really know what it's like. But here, now, we're really getting the real story.
And what about the kinds of questions and commentary about the war? I mean, we know that Egypt will be a much more hostile environment than most of the U.S., but you're paying attention not only there but in Europe. What's the tenor compared to what you've heard and seen coming out of the U.S. press?
Well, it's interesting. I'm also working it out in my own mind. Where do our perceptions come from? Are they formed by the media, or are they formed ahead of that, and then the media comes to cement them and to sort of flow with them. I mean, it's completely clear that the Arab world, almost as one, is standing against this war. And the way they discuss it on television, the panels they have, the way their correspondents approach the story, has that with it. I mean, that is a part of their understanding of what is going on. Whereas in the United States, it would be very different. Europe, again, is another story. I think that there, more than in America, there's more ambivalence amongst the media outlets that are covering it, and that, again, comes out.
Does that leave these different populations at some level seeing or perceiving different wars?
I really would say that that is the case. I would say that over here, there is a sense that A, the war is wrong and shouldn't be going on, but B, more importantly, that it's not going well at all and that America is suffering more casualties and more difficulties than people in America might be thinking at around the same time.
Do Egyptians think that Americans are getting an accurate view of the war?
No, they think that Americans are totally within themselves and have no idea what the war really looks like. Again, there's this sense of looking down on America. America doesn't look outside of itself for its information. I would say that people here, the educated classes and people who are able, do look for other sources of information. I've noticed a lot of people in internet cafes checking out the CNN site or going to see what the BBC has to say. So I think that there is an interest in the other side, but that the mainstream is seeing only one perspective. I think the picture could be more accurate, let's say that.
Where?
Here in Egypt, and what a lot of the Arabs, I think, in the neighboring countries see because of the Al Jazeera channel, I think could be more accurate. That's not to say that in America it is more accurate. I'm just saying from what I'm learning and seeing, it would be good, I think, if people got a more well-rounded picture than what they are getting.
In Egypt. Donna Harmon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Donna Harmon is Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. For more of her reporting from Cairo, go to our website, onpointradio.org. There is a ferocious battle being fought in the United States right now. Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, and more all vying for America's attention.
War with Iraq. Civilians killed in Baghdad, fierce fighting in southern areas. Guerrilla tactics take a toll. U.S. officials repeat, this war is far from over.
Well, it's been a little bit hairy, if you will, in the last couple minutes. We came under some sort of Iraqi artillery or rocket strike. We ducked down inside this armored vehicle that we're riding along in, this M88. And then we could see the flares of the MLRSs, the multiple launch rocket systems of the Americans, firing back in response. Some of the vehicles that...
Progress toward our objectives has been rapid and in some cases dramatic. But as our troops fight, even in isolated areas, there will be casualties. There have been casualties.
They are stupid. They are villains. So why not?
All right, we're going to interrupt this press briefing right now because, of course, the U.S. government would disagree with most of what he is saying.
The big story, a mad dash in the war in Iraq. Huge numbers of Republican guards pour out of Baghdad, beelining for U.S. forces in Najaf. More Iraqi armored columns stream out of Basra and are being attacked by coalition forces. 30,000
The missiles struck at a time of the day when the streets were crowded with people buying food in a residential district in the north of Baghdad. Fire crews and rescue teams were quickly on the scene, but many casualties were beyond all help.
The sound of American television at war. Anisita Hudson was glued to her TV last weekend. While watching a Filipino cable channel's war coverage, she saw her son, Joseph, in a gut-wrenching pan of American POWs captured by Iraqi troops. American networks declined to show the footage, but millions around the world saw it all. What's your assessment of the American media's war coverage in Iraq so far? Are you getting a complete picture of the war? Are you riveted? Is this reality or snapshot theater? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Bob Thompson, professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University and founding director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television. Good evening and welcome, Bob Thompson.
Good evening. Thanks.
Also with us tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you in studio.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Bob Thompson, we're looking at the media tonight and how the American media is portraying this war, how it's coming across. But step back for a moment with us. We've all been so much in the weave of this thing. Paint the big picture for us, the kind of montage, the impact, the message, and something about the American relationship with this war that is emerging from that big picture of media.
Well, you know, the first thing is just the volume of coverage. And by that, I don't mean the amount of information we're getting, because it's a fairly small amount of information being stretched over 72 hours a day of the three cable news networks and a bunch more of the rest of it. I think it's probably safe to say that in the first 5 days of this war, a lot of Americans saw more coverage than they saw in the first 5 years of our involvement in Vietnam, where there wasn't much coverage in the beginning at all. And what's interesting is that every little nuance of change is being dissected and deconstructed. Moods change, not just from month to month, but day to day and minute to minute, practically, in a way that one wonders if we would have had this kind of technological coverage of World War II with all of the ups and downs that war went in, whether we would have been able to complete the 3.5+ years that we fought that war.
To survive it, even at home.
Exactly. But, you know, now we're kind of just as we're seeing these news networks now invent before our very eyes how they're going to cover a war in the 21st century with all of this new technology and the embedding model and all of the rest of it. And I think also we ourselves are inventing before our eyes how we're going to watch it. And some strange things have developed. It seems to be one of the standard ways of doing this now is to watch the basketball game and during the commercials flip to an update on the war over in the news channels. Watch American Idol and during the commercials flip to the news channels to see how the war is going.
So what's the alternative to that?
Well, I mean, I think this material, I mean, now we've got war coverage. You go to your faucet, you turn it on, and water comes out. Mm. Now you can go to a number of sources. Turn it on, and the war comes out. Coverage comes out.
And what's the message, the mood of that coverage that pours endlessly?
Well, it depends on where you turn. I think for the most part, the mainstream broadcast networks are pretty much telling the same story, and it's from an American point of view, as it must by necessity be. It's Americans telling it. There are subtle differences. Fox, of course, is the place you go if you want a little more of the cheerleading, a little more of the attitude, that thing that Fox does, they're doing in the war, just like they were doing before and they will do after. But for the most part, as you're flipping around the different channels, you're essentially still locked within the parameters of our American coverage. People going on the Internet, of course, are finding entirely different things.
And is that saturation the kind of full attention that a well-informed citizen wants to pay, or is it, I don't know, is it something more like attending opera?
Well, that's the tough thing. I mean, the point is, you know, to be a fully informed citizen, of course you don't have to watch this 24 hours a day. One, you couldn't, and two, you wouldn't get that much more from 24 hours a day than you would from occasional grazing. We don't know yet, though, what the calculus is as to how much of this we feel we need to watch. And secondly, you know, I've been watching this stuff now for 7 days, and I'm beginning to realize that quantity does not necessarily make you a better informed citizen, because as we feed from this trough, there are so many nutrients that are not in the feed.
List them.
Pardon me?
List them.
Well, I mean, we're not. For example, I think one of the big things that we really ought to be paying attention to is how the rest of the world is seeing this war. Your last conversation with your last guest it was a good example of that. After this war is over, of course, the issue of diplomacy, repositioning ourselves in the in world opinion, the NATO and the United Nations and all the rest of it, we should come into the end of this war with a really good, sophisticated knowledge of how it was packaged, for the rest of the world.
And instead, we may be getting that tick-tock, moment-to-moment, vivid picture, and not, as you say, the rest of the nutrients. Bob Thompson, I know we have to let you go, but thanks for opening up with that big picture.
Thanks.
Bob Thompson is professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. We're talking tonight about the media at war and the picture we're getting of the fight in Iraq. What's your assessment of war coverage? Is it too friendly, too hostile, too docile? Just write. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the media at war and the picture we're getting of the fight right now in Iraq. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your assessment of American war coverage? Is it too friendly, too hostile, too docile? Just right. Are you getting a complete picture of this war? Is the media being tough-minded and independent, or has it been drafted into the war effort? Which do you want? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, and now from Washington, D.C., by Geneva Overholzer. She is Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri's School of Journalism's Washington Bureau, and former ombudsman for the Washington Post and author of a blog at pointer.org. Good evening and welcome, Geneva Overholzer.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. Sit back with us for a second and look at this avalanche of coverage we're getting, Geneva. What's there? What's not? Is this the right stuff?
Well, Tom, I think you've already had two of the most important points. I hate to just ditto people, but what both Donna and Bob said is right at the top of my list. One thing I'd say is that we are clearly seeing an unprecedented amount, as Bob stressed. But what are we not seeing is what worries me. And one of my answers would be what Donna put her finger on, and that is often we're not seeing the way the rest of the world sees us and sees the war. I think that's a critical lack. A second one is we're not necessarily seeing as much as I would have hoped we'd see of independent reporting. This embedded reporting is a phenomenon, and I don't want to put it down. I think it's an incredible amount of information. I mean, I've seen everything from abdominal surgery by an American military doctor on an Iraqi POW to, you know, internal briefings of troops. It's phenomenal.
And we have listened with rapt attention to the reports of many embedded reporters on this show, and they've brought us a lot of detail we never would have had otherwise.
Exactly. There's no question about it. And I think there's an awful lot to be said for that. I think we don't yet know exactly what the impact of all that is going to be. But we do know that it is increasingly difficult for the unembedded, as it were, the independent reporters. And I think we need to worry about that. And the final thing I would note just in these opening remarks is that we aren't necessarily, and I think I would just flat out state, we aren't getting a broad view. We clearly are getting the mindset of American reporters. I mean, as you mentioned, that's inevitable. But I do worry about the home team attitude. I worry that some of it is sort of technologically wowed. And I worry that there's a kind of a horse race coverage. You know, who's up, who's down, have we got Saddam?
Jack Beatty, you're watching with the rest of us. What do you see? What don't you see? What don't you feel and hear in the coverage we're getting from the enormous American press corps in Iraq?
Well, I frame this in terms of a metaphor, the mirror and the lamp. I think that the media has both functions. It mirrors reality, and then it lights up parts of reality that governments want in the dark. And this embedded strategy, which was cooked up by a former White House, now Pentagon, but former political operative of the Republican Party, is a brilliant example of managing the mirror. It puts us, it is the media showing us what happens. And it is sort of shaping that appearance. And the critical function, you know, asking questions about what you're seeing, the lamp function, has almost been put under a kind of, be with the team. Don't ask the tough question. Don't inquire of the appearance.
But is that true, Jack? Just last night, we did a whole hour on the tough questions that Don Rumsfeld and Ari Fleischer had showered on them yesterday. Is it a matter of balance, you're saying, or?
Well, I'm trying to get back to what we saw on the tube, because we did that. But here's what happened on CNN. Mm. They showed that press conference full of this tough questioning, the defense secretary on the defensive, major question about the strategy of the war. Mm-hmm. Are there enough people for it? And then CNN cut from that to a two of its generals around the big board talking about strategy in the war.
In other words, CNN viewers did not get that fierce back and forth that was on the briefing floor.
The very function of the media to tell the news was abrogated by this, you know, this editing choice to go to the generals who immediately agreed, you know, tone down any criticism, and who, of course, were looking again at the appearance, this board, and, you know, the troops over here and so on, so that you didn't even have the reality didn't even have the dignity of being interpreted. It wasn't. It just went by. And unless you were watching it, literally, they weren't going to tell you the news.
The tough stuff wasn't there. Geneva Overholzer, you talked about this home team posture. And, of course, the country is at war, and people want to support troops who are in harm's way. What's the right balance for the press at war? Where should they be? Should they be ruthlessly independent, even at war? Is it different during wartime? Are we close to the right balance this time?
Well, part of what I worry about, Tom, is that this has been wartime, supposedly, then, ever since 9/11. And these questions of whether or not we are understanding that part of our role as journalists is indeed to be skeptical. It is patriotic of journalists to be skeptical. That's our role in a democracy. It worries me that I think in part out of our own humanity and the fears and concerns people have felt after 9/11, journalists are, after all, human, but also because this administration is so popular and I would say has sometimes used that public popularity as a kind of bludgeon over the head of journalists, you know, this whole atmosphere of you're not patriotic if you're questioning. I'm afraid the press has been too inclined to be enormously mindful of that. And
you're saying the mighty American press is cowed by that cudgel?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we all know, anyone who's watched the press seriously knows that we're all too inclined to be cowed, especially lately. I think this participates in a larger question of corporate journalism pressures and increasing consolidation. And yeah,
you're saying it's a bottom line issue somehow. How do you get from the president's popularity to the sort of cudgel that he can use to upbraid the press to the profit?
Because the press is worried about what the public thinks of them, and press owners want us to be. I don't mean to be too simplistic about this. It's not just a bottom line question. It's a whole atmosphere in America today about how you be a good American. And I do believe that in addition to that, we have the question of how you be a good corporate media person. And the two are not unrelated. But more than the corporate question is this sense of, you know, am I a good American as well as a good journalist? Now, plenty of people overseas are asking tough questions, and plenty of people at home are. And I would take a little bit of exception to Jack's characterization of how we got the embedding. As a Washingtonian, I have observed this process being developed, and the bureau chiefs here were a very important part of developing the process.
And absolutely clamoring for it after the shutout or partial shutout during Gulf War I.
Exactly.
I mean, they wanted to be there. Geneva, Jack Beatty, stand by. A mountain of callers were to join this conversation. I want to invite them in. David's calling. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jack and Professor Overholzer. I wanted to share an email I received from Bob Schieffer of CBS News' Meet the Press. You probably recall the day before the end of that deadline, on March 16th, Vice President Dick Cheney went on CBS News, Meet the Press, and I think Face the Nation. I sent an email the next day through their online feedback, not expecting really to receive any response, and I didn't receive anything from Tim Russert, but I actually got a reply directly from Bob Schieffer. I had said, you know, basically a pretty brief email saying, hey, you had Dick Cheney there in front of you all that time yesterday, and you didn't ask him about Halliburton. You know, he's continuing to receive payments from Halliburton, the big oil field services company.
Okay.
And I got a response from Bob Schieffer, that two sentences. We're about to go to war. I hardly think it was the time to get into that sort of thing.
Wow.
Well, but Geneva, put yourself in Bob Schieffer's shoes. At that moment, on the eve of war, I mean, we understand David's question loud and clear, a million questions out there, but is there a time and place issue here?
I'd like to put myself into Schieffer's shoes and say that if we are, in fact, as has been true in recent months, buying 90% of Iraq's oil, then that is a question a newsman ought to have on his mind, whether we're about to go to war or not.
Jack?
Yeah, let's get back to that. Tim Russert, in his interview with Cheney, asked Cheney about nuclear weapons in Iraq, and Cheney said, quote, Iraq has reconstituted its nuclear weapons program. Russert then said, well, Mohammed El-Baradei, the weapons inspector, says he's found no evidence. Cheney said, well, I disagree. I think it's there. That was the end of it. Russert did not say, but wait a minute, the evidence upon which you're basing this has to do with a forged document. That's how they were supposedly the Iraqis were supposedly getting the uranium from Niger.
Right.
And that was a forged document, Mr. Vice President. So do you have some other source? And then if Cheney had said, well, we have other sources, then Russert could have said, well, if you have other sources and you know where these things are, why haven't you told the inspectors? And what his response to that, I don't know, would have been either. And on a further piece of information, available in Newsweek, available on the web, is the administration cites this document from the defector who came into Jordan in 1995, who told them, Saddam has a nuclear weapons program. Here it is. Go find it. He's been cited for years the source on that. That same man, later on in that interview, said, we destroyed our biological and chemical weapons in 1991. That has been suppressed. But that document is now available, and Tim Russert didn't even think to ask that.
So it's a big, hairy ball of wax we'll look at. I mean, to fairness to Tim Russert, in the same interview he asked, what if we are received not as liberators but as conquerors in Iraq? This is not a popular kind of question, the kind Dick Cheney's going to want to get. And, of course, he said, well, we think it's all going to just open up to us. But I wonder if this isn't only about attitude, but as Geneva Overholzer says, related in a way to the corporate aspect here, the tempo of American journalism has become such that I'm not sure listeners are prepared to sit and listen to a complex interrogation of Dick Cheney on a big national program like Tim Russert's. Let's get another voice in this conversation. Christopher Hansen is with us tonight. He's assistant professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. He's a 20-year print journalist and combat correspondent in the first Gulf War and reported from Rwanda. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Hansen.
Hi, how are you?
Well, great, thanks. Christopher Hansen, we're looking at the American media's performance so far in coverage of the war in Iraq. We on this show have been recipients of many frontline reports from correspondents there. We can hear the grit in their teeth and that it's no fun at all. They're embedded, and that's a sandstorm these days, and cold food. But what's your sense overall of what we're getting in terms of coverage? Is it the right stuff?
Well, some of the right stuff. I think this is a work in progress. I agree with the other guests that we're not getting enough of a foreign perspective, and I even heard some BBC TV coverage the other day that was clearly more skeptical, even though they have their own troops in there. On the other hand, I have been more impressed than I thought I would be with the embedded coverage. It has all the limitations, the other guests said. The reporters are dependent upon the unit they're with for their very lives. They bond with them. Kind of Stockholm syndrome even kicks in, and so it's obviously biased toward the unit they're with. On the other hand, when that unit gets into difficulties, they report it. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that when things started to get difficult and the embedded reporters started to report on it, that the Central Command went after the Iraqi TV transmitter, because initially the embedded coverage was magnifying all of the supposed successes that were going on, and when things started to become more difficult, you might say it magnified, and without context, the difficulties.
Christopher Hansen, you report
which might have given boosted the morale of the Iraqis, so they went after their TV.
You reported on the first Gulf War, Christopher Hansen. How do you, of course, you were in the field that time, not watching back at home, but your sense of the difference between that war and this, that was described as a hugely orchestrated public image war.
Well, absolutely. I was one of a relatively few reporters who were out there with combat units. I was with the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Iraq, and it was very difficult to report report what was going on, partly because of the communications. We couldn't get our dispatches back, in good time. And so what we were seeing, even if we were seeing things that might have been not exactly along the party line, it wouldn't appear for a couple of days.
It didn't even make it back, and now they've got fairly direct communications. We speak directly to them on their cell phones. A lot of callers want to come in. Dan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I have a couple of points. I think, first off, the coverage focuses far too narrowly on strictly military engagements and far too little on the larger strategic situation.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, I wanted to share my thoughts. It seems as if the media and the military have coordinated together to present to us something of a revolution in the real TV phenomenon. Here we have the season series of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and yet it's not real. It's real TV of war, and yet it's not real.
What's not real about it, Dan?
Well, we're not. Yeah, I went on the internet the other day to look at some of the images that Al Jazeera has on their site, and they're really horrific. And I can't say that I want to see those things, but we are definitely, the U.S. public is kept at a distance. We aren't really confronted with what the realities of war are. Instead, what we're seeing fall into the categories either of endearing stories about brave soldiers and gripping adventure, or reassuring documentaries about the technological sophistication that should reinvoke illusions of invulnerability that we had and lost after 9/11. And all of this, I think, affects public opinion significantly, because the people who are human to us on these images are, of course, the U.S. soldiers. Mm-hmm. We're taught, racism is so prevalent in our society that we're taught long before we see these images, to really fear the faces of terrorism.
Of course, those American soldiers are of many races themselves. But you're a close and good observer of what's out there, Dan. Thank you for your call, Geneva Overholzer. How about it? Are we too caught up in that here's our soldier and the devil take the hindmost on the rest? Is it the media's job to put the full gore of war right there on the screen?
It is the media's job to put the full story on the screen. And if war doesn't have gore, what does war have, alas? We aren't here to protect people, although clearly we should operate within the bounds of journalistic ethics. That includes everything from being sure we don't show pictures of the dead and imprisoned until we know that the next of kin have been alerted. We operate by those rules at home. Operating according to rules of taste, you don't just gratuitously use gore and violence. But we surely shouldn't keep things off the air just because Donald Rumsfeld doesn't want them on the air. But I wanted to mention one other thing, if I could, Tom, listening to that caller who did make, as you said, some interesting points. One thing we ought to acknowledge is the other two new technology in this war, and even up against Gulf War I, as you said, is the internet. He said he went online to look at Al Jazeera. You can go online to look at ArabNews.com. You can go online to hear the BBC, to look at Le Monde. You can go online for a lot of things. That doesn't mean the average American is getting it.
But the alternate view is out there. Geneva Overholzer, hold the thought. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the media at war and the picture we're getting of the fight in Iraq. How about those live feeds from embedded reporters? Are you riveted? Is this reality or snapshot theater? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the media at war and the picture we're getting of the fight in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Are you getting a complete picture of the war? And what about the blood, the gore? The cameras are there. Should they show it? Should they show the POWs, the American dead, the Iraqi dead? And what does it mean that the rest of the world gets a different picture than the USA? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255.
423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, from Washington, by Geneva Overholzer, Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri Journalism School's Washington Bureau, and from Big Sur, California, and University of Maryland, Christopher Hansen, Assistant Professor of Journalism there, and a 20-year print journalist and combat correspondent in the first Gulf War. Reporters with the troops, or embedded journalists, as the Pentagon calls them, are covering this war with a unique first-time, first-hand immediacy. Drew Brown is military correspondent in Washington with Knight Ridder. He's now embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division. I asked him today where he is now and if he's seen action in the last 24 hours.
Right now, we're in the desert. It's been sucked in by a sandstorm for the last 3 days. It's been pretty awful, quite frankly. It seems to have lifted here somewhat. The company that I'm with, no, we have not been in direct action in the last 24 hours. However, there has been a number of battles going on around us. This morning, the Iraqis took an opportunity of a break in the weather to try to send out an armored probe of the American position. And artillery and tanks destroyed, I think it was about a dozen Iraqi tanks and armored personnel carriers, and killed quite a number of Iraqi soldiers.
Drew Brown, let me ask you. In Washington, you are military affairs reporter for Knight Ridder, so you follow the military a lot. From your perspective, how is this embed or the embedding process going? Are you seeing what you need to see? What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, really, I mean, I couldn't ask to be in a better spot. You know, I mean, I'm with a frontline unit, a mechanized infantry unit. I've been with them for about 15 days. There's been absolutely no restrictions whatsoever on our reporting. You know, these guys have taken us in. There's myself and a photographer, David Gilkey, from the Detroit Free Press. And, you know, we're pretty much part of the company now. I mean, we're you know, part of the guys. We're bonded by misery, so to speak. It's been pretty awful out here. I really don't see how the Pentagon could have done it better. As far as giving reporters access and an opportunity to report on, you know, what's really going on out here, we get to see a good up-close at the front picture. The problem is that we can't really see the big picture in a lot of times. I mean, I have to rely on my editors back home a lot to tell me what's going on. And I listen to the radio. I mean, if it weren't for BBC, a lot of this would be in the dark out here.
Are there specific things that you're asked not to report on?
Well, I mean, there are certain ground rules we agreed to. Before, you know, when we signed on, I mean, we could not get exact locations, we could not report on upcoming operations or plans, that kind of thing. We have agreed not to publish the names of casualties. Given the conditions out here, those are pretty reasonable.
And when you say that at this point you've become part of the company, bonded by misery, and we can surely hear that, do you have any concern about that crimping your objectivity as the campaign goes forward?
Of course, that's always a concern, but I was sent over here to report, you know, on American troops and what they're going through. If I were over here unilaterally, you know, in Baghdad or somewhere like that, yeah, of course it would be different. You try to do your best, you know, you try not to lose your objectivity. But is that going to, I mean, is that going to compromise me as a reporter? No, I don't think so.
Drew Brown, it's great talking with you. Thank you very much for joining us, and be safe there.
All right, it's my pleasure.
Drew Brown is correspondent with Knight Ridder, embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq. He spoke with us from southern Iraq. Christopher Hansen, Geneva Overholzer there. We hear an awful lot in that one interaction. I mean, he's describing himself as, you know, pretty much part of the company now, part of the guys bonded by misery. And yet, as a journalist, he's very aware of the potential pitfalls of that. He says he gets the up-close picture but can't get the big picture. So we get a lot of that grit and detail from these embedded reporters. But as you said, Christopher Hansen, there's something maybe in the big picture that's harder to get our hands around.
I think so, but it's possible when you're out with a unit to report on things that the unit commander doesn't necessarily want you to. I mean, because in the last Gulf War, I made a point of, as a pool reporter, of describing in very graphic detail the casualties that I saw, mainly the Iraqi casualties. Mm. And I did it even though normally it would have been regarded in rather poor taste, because I thought it was important to get that point of view out there. As far as the big picture goes, I think that you have to rely on the people in Washington pretty heavily to try to provide the context. What I see watching the overall coverage of the war is not necessarily a totally pro-U.S., pro-military perspective. I mean, the here are things I know just from watching American TV news and reading the papers. That unanticipated attacks on the support columns, the
nasty
the
surprise,
that they're not finding any weapons of mass destruction yet, and that a lot of people think that maybe they didn't send enough people over there to accomplish the objective. About all of that, just from watching the American reports, so it can't be. It's obviously not totally slanted toward the administration's point of view.
And yet, we wonder what's not there. I should say, we talk with a lot of these embedded reporters. We have great respect for the work that they're doing, the risks that they're taking, the situation they're in. It's easy to sit back in a padded chair in the United States. And as you hear, as you heard just now, here's a reporter who knows very well the pitfalls of the work he's doing, and yet he's bringing back that firsthand report. Is it the right balance overall? Harry's calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you taking the call.
Good to have you.
I'm concerned about some of the reporting that's being done by the media. I listen to NPR quite a bit. And earlier, a few days ago, you had an interview with a gentleman who was with a subcontractor of a rather large industrial giant in the country.
Okay.
Who explained in great detail how inexpensive it was to attach some things to a rocket bomb. To make it a smart bomb.
These are American munitions that the Pentagon has been very very upfront in saying it has turned into smart bombs.
Yes, and the interview explained exactly how that was done. It could be done for $20,000. I can do one of those. The target for some folks like Saddam and the folks that he supports could be troops over in the Gulf. Could be a target here in this country.
So you've got the concern of too much information on a point there that could actually raise dangers for American troops. Harry, thanks for your call. Geneva Overholzer, how about that? Do we have too much information on some counts and not enough on others? How do you see it?
Well, I have to say, I understand the gentleman's concern. I always feel strongly that a kind of fear like that needs to be answered in part by, isn't this information probably widely available? I don't think that that is representative of the concerns we need to have about what we're hearing, frankly. I also wanted to say I thought your interview with Drew Brown was remarkably concise in crystallizing precisely the strengths and the limitations of the embedded troops. And one thing that has occurred to me, and this is not exactly on the question of how we're learning about this war, but I think one thing this embedding is going to do is break down a difficult relationship between the military and journalists. And in fact, in the long run, that will only be good for this country because the military and journalism have got to have a healthier communication. And the fact is the two groups who are dying over there, in addition to civilians, lamentably, are these two professions. And I think it may help the public understand journalists better, too, at work.
But does that mean cheerleading is what we should expect, Geneva?
No, I mean, as I said, I thought that interview raised exactly the points. Of course we don't want cheerleading. But I can't help thinking that isn't it good in the end that at least the military and journalism would understand each other better? That doesn't mean they're on the same side, quote unquote. It doesn't mean they're going to say the same thing. But you can't report on something unless you understand it well. And it's a lot better to have some level of trust between these two institutions, which are very important to our democracy.
Of course, all that has developed in these early days of war when the country naturally has this tendency to rally around the flag very hard. If things go forward and are not so clean.
Right. This is a work in progress, as Chris said.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Can this marriage go on if the war drags out? Is the media now, or parts of it, perpetually in a kind of go-go relationship with the government?
Yeah, embedded is a lot like embedded, and for years one of the criticisms of American media generally is that it's in bed with the powerful. And this is, I think, a kind of metaphor for the ultimate co-option of the press. Sure, it's great to have these details, but, you know, for example, we heard about the – everybody feels it when the POWs were shown. I didn't see – I looked at Fox and I looked at CNN. No one brought up that I could see the irony of our complaining about the Iraqis not obeying the Geneva Convention, since in Afghanistan, on the choice of Donald Rumsfeld, we threw out the Geneva Convention and violated it something like 26 times in the way we have handled the Taliban and other prisoners at Guantanamo. And yet none of them brought that up. And one of the criticisms of Rumsfeld at the time was, by God, what if our people are ever taken captive?
Stripes of big questions that are going to go on and on. Bravery on the one hand and a lot of reporting we really count on, we admire, we respect, and we're glad to have. At the same time, at this top level, are we asking all the tough questions? It's been a fascinating hour. I want to thank you, Christopher Hansen, for joining us from Big Sur, California tonight. Christopher Hansen is Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Maryland, and Geneva Overholzer. Wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining
Thanks.
Us.
Great to be here.
Geneva Overholzer, joining us from Washington tonight, is Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Reporting at the University of Missouri School of Journalism's Washington Bureau. Jack Beatty, good to have you as well. Stand by for ongoing coverage of the war in Iraq. Go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, remembering Daniel Patrick Moynihan. This is On Point. Former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan died today at age 76. The New York Democrat served in the Senate for 24 years and was a leading voice on some of the defining issues of his time, from welfare reform to national security. Before his first run for the Senate in 1976, Moynihan served in the administrations of four consecutive presidents, from Kennedy to Ford. The Almanac of American Politics once hailed him as the nation's best thinker among politicians since Lincoln, and its best politician among thinkers since Jefferson. Moynihan's friend and successor, Hillary Rodham Clinton, announced his death on the Senate floor earlier this evening.
We have lost a great American, an extraordinary senator, an intellectual, and a man of passion and understanding about what really makes this country great. He understood that being a United States senator was a precious trust. And anyone who ever heard him speak knows the experience of learning more than you ever thought possible in a short period of time. He could explain and expound on such a range of subjects that it took my breath away.
Hillary Rodham Clinton announcing the death today of Daniel Patrick Moynihan on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Jack Beatty, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a singular senator.
Yes, an intellectual in politics and a lover of what he would have called sesquipedalian rhetoric.
Oh, Lord. Definition, please.
He loved the big word, and he loved the flowing 18th-century construction. And just to see him orate spontaneously on the Senate floor was a rare treat. His references could go from Dante to Macaulay to something that Lord Melbourne said to Lord Cecil. It was a treat. And, you know, his main contributions in American life were through his writing, which at the one hand made him prominent and on the other hand brought him all kinds of grief. And much of his writing, at least early on, was around the situation of the black family. In the 1960s, he wrote a paper which called Moynihan Report that basically said, in addition to slavery and racism and all the rest, there had been generated a kind of welfare dependency in black communities, rising illegitimacy and so on, a tangle of pathology, he used that phrase. And this, he was alive to that partly because his own life had so much in it. His father left his family when he was 10, and they were essentially abandoned. And he had to go to work as a shoeshine boy. In fact, he was shining shoes on the day Pearl Harbor was announced. So instability and, if you will, pathology in a family was something he well understood. But he was attacked for that report, even though it recommended all kinds of liberal things, for blaming the victim, for blaming these problems on the black family rather than seeing this as something done to them. And then later on, he got in trouble again when he was with President Nixon, when in a memo he said that race relations had improved, the situation of black American was getting much better, but we now need to have talk about race in a period of benign neglect. Well, he never heard the last of that one.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, dead today at age 76. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.